Speaking this week about Rav Elchanan and Wasserman, we gave already two shiurim, one on Rabbi Akiva, one on the Maram in Rutenberg. And both of those are older, and one's almost 2,000 years, and one goes several hundred years back. And the narrative is somewhat simple, not so. Our Masorah, our understanding about it, what we take from it, the lessons from it, so that's kind of accepted. And we understand what Rabbi Akiva did, and we understand what Rabbi Amram Rittenberg did, and the lessons then we apply as we see appropriate. Now, it's not to say that there is no tension in those stories, even within the Rabbi Akiva story. We saw himself that there was questionable, that he was asked by tzaddikim of his time, why do you continue to teach Torah, even though the Romans are going to come and get you, right? That question was asked, and Rabbi Akiva took care of it, and we've moved on. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was one of the kedoshim of the Holocaust, And some of the themes, and I was debating how to go through them and what to include and what not to include, and I'm going to include whatever we can. There is tension there. There is questions about what he did, what his activities were. I'm going to try to be as objective as possible. But Rav Elchanan is still debated. Ad Yom Hazeh, things that he said, things that he did, things that he recommended to others. So let's go back. Rav Elchanan was born, I believe, in 1870. I wrote it down here someplace. Born in 1874. He learned in the tradition in the major yeshivas of that time. He learned in Telz under Rav Shimon Shkup and Rav Elazar Gordon. He found his way to Brisk, where he learned under Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He then found his way to Radin, where he learned under the Chafetz Chaim. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman is known as being the Talmud Muvak of the Chafetz Chaim, which is interesting. In fact, today I talked to Rav Uri Greenspan. I asked him, give me three quick things about Rav Elchanan, because he's from the yeshiva world more and doesn't like the side stories. He's just like, what's the main thing? So he said, Talmud L'Chafetz Chaim, and author of the Kovitz Shurim, and the Rav of Baranovich. So he learned by L'Chafetz Chaim, went with L'Chafetz Chaim to exile. During World War I, all the yeshivas that were in Lithuania and Poland had to move into Russia in order to avoid the Germans. So he went with him into Russia, came back after that, found himself in the town of Baranovich. Baranovich was a fairly new town. In the late 1800s, it found its way on the at a railroad crossing. It's a railroad town in the late 1800s and quickly grew to be 10,000-20,000 people, the majority Jewish people, and there was a yeshiva there. The yeshiva was founded as a Beis Yosef yeshiva from Novartek. Novartek is a fascinating story in its own right. They set up a chain of yeshivas throughout Europe. One of them was in Baranovich. Rav Elchanan Wasserman became the Rosh Yeshiva of that yeshiva. Now, it's a little different than the other yeshivas. The other yeshivas were post-late teens, early 20s, maybe even a kollel that went along with it. Baranovich was more like a high school. If you don't think about it, it's hard to think about it that way, but it was more of the high school-age people, 12, 13, 14, 15, and with the idea to prepare them to then move on to the higher-level yeshivas at that time, Slobodka, Mir, Telz, Radin, those places, which we've also heard about. Elchanan Wasserman was the Rosh Yeshiva, gave the older classes, and it quickly became somewhat of a magnet. It reached about 300 Talmidim, which meant that it was a large yeshiva, but in terms of how many Jews there were, I think there are 10,000 Jews in Baranovich, and there are 300 people in the yeshiva. Right now, nowadays, it's most known for the yeshiva, but that Lithuanian Jewry was not completely Orthodox, as much as some you might want to think about it that way. That's not the case. When I remember reading his biography and learning a little bit about him when I was a teenager, when I was in yeshiva, and I was really taken by a Rav Elchanan. First of all, if you look at pictures of him, he's taller than everyone else, so I felt connected with him in that way. I learned his sefer, I guess, that is, even though he didn't actually write it, Kovitz Shurim. Kovitz Arus, I think, was written by him. That's on the Sechas Yevamos. Kovitz Shurim is a classic in Achronim literature, and it is but it's in small chunks. I mean, you don't have learn something from Chidushi or Shimon Shkup. It's five pages. You got to spend a week trying to figure out what he's talking about. Small chunks. You have Akasha and the Gar. He looks there. He brings out in a new way that one may never thought of before. There are classic ideas that he put out that have now become the accepted way of teaching it. The idea of psikresh de lo nichale on Shabbos, which is a very important concept. The idea that something is going to happen, but it's not in my not in my interest for it to happen. So all those things having to do with electricity on Shabbos, a lot of that comes from an idea that Rav Elchanan put forth. He has an idea in Kovitz Shurim Chelik Beis, this is Chelik Aleph, and in the second section he has included a thing called Kuntras Divrei Sofrim, which he himself wrote. So we've learned that several times between Mincha Marv and Shulchan Torah Shabbal Peshirim. That was Kuntras Divrei Sofrim, and understanding the Rabbanan works. How do the Rabbanan work? How did the Mishnah work? How does the Gemara work? That was something that was put out by him, and in fact it makes sense. If he was dealing with younger Talmidim, getting them ready for advanced yeshivas, you could very well see how that would be something that he would focus on. So the other aspect of him that I found personally inspiring was that he was always a Talmud. He was always, throughout his life, he was always seeking others. In fact, he always left his yeshiva for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I still find that very odd. To go to daven either by the Chafetz Chaim or in Kelm, which is known as a real Musar yeshiva. He would go someplace else. He felt he could gain greater inspiration there. He left his Talmidim. It's interesting. But that fact that he was always looking to continue to learn, and not, you know, that was something that I always admired. Nevertheless, he was groomed for leadership. As being the Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim, it was assumed that he was going to be the next Gadol Dor. In fact, the concept that we know today as, that's known today as Das Torah, probably, I could do a little more research on this, was probably most put out by Rav Elchanan Wasserman. The idea that we've turned to the Gedolim for everything. Whatever they, if somebody is well steeped in Torah and they know all of Torah, they should be able to answer questions about anything. So that comes from Rav Elchanan. Now there is a shir that, a pretty popular shir that was put up by Rav Ari Leibowitz a couple of weeks ago, entitled, How to Teach Our Children About Gedolei Yisrael, where he tells a story from Rav Zelig Epstein, that Rav Zelig Epstein is the Rosh, I believe he passed away, but he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Shari Torah, Rabbi Steinberg, learned by Rav Zelig Epstein. And the Talmidim once asked him, he was talking about what it was like as the Holocaust was beginning, how everybody was trying to make their own plans, trying to figure out where to go. So one of his Talmidim asked him, I don't understand, how could it be that everybody had a different thing to do? Didn't they follow Das Torah? To which he answered, well, you have to understand, the term Das Torah wasn't invented yet at that time. Right? It was a very deep point. It wasn't so accepted then. In order for such a concept to take hold, you need gedolim that are willing to say their opinions on matters that perhaps are not totally connected to Torah, that are not, you know, in answering Akasha, and right? And you need somebody to push that philosophy. I mean, for somebody to get up and say, hi, I'm the Gadol Dor, and therefore you have to listen to me, it's not going to work so well. For somebody to say, he's the Gadol Hador, and therefore you have to listen to him, right? So then that can have a much greater effect. So that was Rav Elchanan. Rav Elchanan was saying, the Chafetz Chaim said this, and therefore we all have to listen to what the Chafetz Chaim said. Rav Chaim Ozer said this. Now, Rav Chaim Ozer and Rav Elchanan Wasserman were brothers-in-law. I believe Chaim Ozer was somewhat older, but they were brothers. They both married sisters of the same parents, right? So they were very close. And after the Chafetz Chaim passed away, so Rav Elchanan said, Rav Chaim Ozer said this, and therefore we all have to listen to him. That is the background to entering the story of Rav Elchanan Wasserman and the Holocaust. Now, I believe, figuring out where to start this story, I think you really have to go to 1937, which is when Rav Elchanan Wasserman went to America. Now, Rav Elchanan Wasserman became Rosh Yeshiva in Baranovich in 1920 or so, so 15, 17 years. Rav Baranovich was known for being particularly poor, that the students there were living on very little, and he's trying to raise funds. He had the responsibility for raising money for the whole yeshiva, and it was very difficult. And he decided, ultimately, what many Rosh Yeshiva had to do at that time, was to go to America. That is significant, first of all, because going to America wasn't going for a week and then flying back. It was going for, as he did, for a year and a half. Right? And it was also all kind of placing somebody in a totally different world. showing up in America. America is a completely different civilization than what existed in way Eastern Europe. Even today, these places, Baranovich is a totally backwards town. There is a book here, Traveling with the Maggid, Rabbi Pesach Kron. He led a tour of Lithuania, where, and he goes through the stories of all the places that he shared, of Mir, Novardik, Panovich, Tels, Kelm, Kovna, Slobodka. He talks about going to Baranovich. It's still completely poor. There is the yeshiva itself became a gymnasium. And when they went in, they said, be careful, don't touch the stuff, because the athletes in there are training for the Olympics. You walked in, place is total dump. Everything is rusty, everything is... That was the situation. Now, imagine what the situation was then. So he came to America in order to try to raise funds. He came in October 1937. And... A story, I guess, that I found today in A Fire in His Soul. That's Rav Irving. That's the biography of Rav Irving Bunim put together by his son, obviously, right? So he tells the story here that Torah for Rabbi Wasserman and other Gedolim was more than just another body of knowledge or source of sustenance. It was the life itself, the source of the spiritual energy that sustained the world. Rav Elchanan used to say, Bunim recalls, that there are certain mitzvos between man and fellow man whose reward is in part interest received in this world and whose principle remains in the world to come. And then he explains, and I'll skip, he explains that any mitzvah that's done men adam lechavero is done on their behalf and also done because Hashem told me to do it and therefore I get reward in the world to come. So why is Talmud Torah greater than all of it, he asks, right? Talmud Torah has only been adam lechavero. It's only been adam lemakom. It's only between man and God. It's not been adam lechavero. So why does that then get credit as being greater than all of them? So he says in the last paragraph, because Torah is what supports the entire world. If we would stop learning Torah, God forbid, then the world would go under. The existence of the world depends on the Jews learning Torah. So not only is it ben adam lemakom that I'm doing it for Hashem, but my Talmud Torah is what is actually sustaining the whole world. Which is classic, what we call today, Haredi philosophy. That is, Torah is it, and nothing else, really, everything else is really subservient to the learning of Torah. Now, Rav Elchanan comes to America. There's several stories of the culture shock that he experienced. There's a famous story of him being driven through Times Square, and Rav Elchanan kept his eyes down whenever he was in America at all, anywhere. He kept his eyes down. He wouldn't look more than Dalet Amos in front of him. And the story goes, he's going through Times Square, and he kind of turns to this driver and says, "Where are we? I feel totally." Feel like a totally impure right now. And he said, oh yeah, this is a pretty bad part of town, just keep your head down. And he kept driving through, and like he could have had trouble breathing until he left Times Square. But that's one of the famous stories that they say about him. Barak Kefet has a story that when a donor came to him and says, you know, my child's getting married, here is $100 for the yeshiva, I want you to be Masadar Kedushin. $100 significant. So Rav Elchanan said, okay, fine, I'll be Masadar Kedushin. So he is Masadar Kedushin, the wedding is, the chuppah is then over, and like any good American couple, the groom kisses the bride right in front of him. And he can't believe it. So he's like, so they go over to him and say, you know, calm down. What's the problem? They're married now. They're allowed to kiss each other. That's the problem. So he said, yeah. But what are the last words in the Torah? The last words in the Torah are, Leinei Kol Yisrael, in the eyes of all the Jewish people. What happens if it's done, Leinei Kol Yisrael? The Torah ends. After the words, Leinei Kol Yisrael, the Torah is then over. That's a vort, but I think that nicely expresses the culture clash that may have existed between Rav Elchanan and coming to America. Now, this is part of what I was hesitant to bring up, but I think it does very much relate to the story. It is very well known that Rav Elchanan refused to come to Yeshiva University. That when many Rosh Yeshiva came to America, so they were convinced to come to YU. In Rabbi Kefet's book on Bernard Revel, he talks about how when Rav Aaron Cutler first came to America, Rabbi Revel invited him to come to Yeshiva. Rav Aaron Cutler was very hesitant. He had heard all these things. He sent somebody to convince him. Rav Aaron Cutler, he says here, Rav Aaron Cutler came to YU in order to give a shir. That itself is a chiddush to me, but he said Rav Aaron Cutler came. Others came as well. Rav Shimon Shkaf was Rosh Yeshiva in YU for a while and almost stayed. There were significant Talmid Chacham that came to YU. Rav Elchanan is, as far as I know, the only one.
Rabbi Shkaf's
at where? So where Rav Chanan Wasserman refused to come to YU. So they even sent somebody to go get him, and he still refused to come. So he says, why? So I have here in source number 2 at the bottom, he said the person who went to him was Hirsch Menashevitz. Hirsch Menashevitz of Menashevitz Matzah fame. So proprietor of the kosher food company. So Dean Zar wrote, Mr. Menashevitz related to me that Rav Chanan Wasserman, in the presence of 25 people, declared that the yeshiva is a center of apikoros and shmad. I mean, conversion away from Judaism, since the writings of Zunz, Geiger, and Isaac Hirschweiss are all studied in yeshiva. These men attempted to completely uproot Judaism. So Mr. Manashevitz asked him 2 questions. Did you discuss this with the heads of the yeshiva? Rav Elchanan said, no, he hadn't. So he said, may I tell them? So Rav Elchanan said that if the yeshiva situation could be improved, then you're at liberty to quote these criticisms. You know, Rav Elchanan was no fooling around. There's actually a story in the biography of Rav Elchanan Wasserman that he came to Philadelphia, and he got all upset at the rabbi that he heard allowed ballroom dances or something. And Rav Elchanan was furious at him. How could you allow such a thing to happen? And he said, well, if they don't come to our shul to do this, they're going to go to the nightclub and do this. So to which Rav Elchanan responded, do you put out a fire by putting on more gasoline? Right? So there was no change with him. He saw this is the truth, and nothing can be changed from the truth. And that, I believe, is very relevant as one then continues on with the story. So he was here he was in America for a year and a half. He was quite a figure in America. He went to city. Thousands of people came to hear him. He gave big drushes in order to raise money for his yeshiva. And ultimately, it was time for him to go back. So,
where did he do these drushes?
In shuls. He would go to cities. He'd go to Chicago, he went to St. Louis, he went to Cincinnati. So he didn't go to YU, but he'd go to shuls. And there's actually another story here. I assume he spoke in Yiddish. That's my assumption, right? We read these stories in books, and everything's in English. So I said, sure, he came. highly doubt that he spoke. I mean, most shuls were speaking Yiddish still at that time. Yeah. So this is, but I think, believe there are, there might be recordings even of him coming to America. I'm not sure. But October 1937, so he was here till March 1939. And he said it's now time to go back. Now, March 1939 is already, there are serious things going on in Europe. It's very clear that things are going in a bad direction. That's already after the whole discussion about German boycotts. The Nazi Party is very much in power already at that time. And he's ready to go back. Now, there's a story here which gives me chills, that Rav Shraga Block was the person who drove him around. So his faithful driver, the source number 3, begged Rav Elchanan with tears in his eyes not to leave. Rebbe, you're not allowed to travel, he cried out excitedly with deep anxiety. And to which Rav Elchanan responded, since when does Mr. Block give halachic rulings regarding what is forbidden and what is permitted? I mean, how can you tell me? So Rav Elchanan replied, Rav Shraga was shocked and deeply hurt. Those presents were also astonished by Rav Elchanan's sharp rejoinder, so unlike his normal behavior. Subsequently, they realized Rav Elchanan himself was torn by inner conflict and was fighting to strengthen his resolve. And he's going to get to the bottom line of that paragraph, I underlined, and again, people were convincing him not to go, and he said, I'm a soldier, I have to go to the front. Right? And that was his hashkafa. He said, I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, I have to go, and I'm going to be with my Talmidim. Now, it was you could see already here, he knew what was happening. Now, he didn't necessarily know that he was going to be, that the Holocaust was going to happen in the way that it was, but there is much more proof that he was understanding all of this as being part of the, the Chevli Mashiach, the birth pangs of Mashiach coming out. And he writes this. If you see in footnote number 11 there, it says, Rav Elchanan repeated similar statements several times during the winter months, despite the premonition that catastrophe was approaching. During Sivan, he was among the guests of the Sternbach family in London, meaning he went back to England, and then he ended up at the Sternbachs, which is Rav Moshe Sternbach's parents, who's still alive today. And rumor had it, on the fourth line, rumor had it that war with Poland was likely any day. He answered, the captain does not desert the ship in a storm, and 2, his remaining away would not help. And this is a key line, I think, to understanding this story. These are birth pangs of the Mashiach, and it has been decreed upon us to bear them. No one can escape or avoid his assigned portion of the birth pangs of Mashiach. He assumed, even though things look bad in Germany, and then by extension things look bad in Eastern Europe, he assumed that if these are, and he assumed that they were, the Chevli Mashiach, it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter. You could be in America, you could think that you're safe. These things are going to now impact the entire world, so there is no sense in him not going back to Eastern Europe. And therefore he went back. He wrote several pamphlets. In fact, one of them is translated into English, Pangs of the Messiah, I forget the exact term, and I had it. Sorry, Javelin had it, he gave it to me. I think it was sent out of one of the stuck organizations several years ago, and I just couldn't find it. I looked all over, I couldn't find it in my possession. But it's translated from other works that he put together. There is a book here, Kovetz Mamarim, which are a collection of, amongst other things, his writings about the assumption that Mashiach is about to come. So just to lead off, this is of several pages, but just to get a flavor of what this is like, he writes here, Hatkufa ha'uvris aleinu, that source number four, right? Be'ez hi ha'kufa miyuchedes b'mina, right? This is a specific moment in time, al b'meis chai Yisrael be'ikr, where many of the Jews could die. Ad raya lanu hofos asher lo she'arnu mi'olam, and things that we have never seen in the world. Ha'ma'orus misfartzim aleinu b'mihirus bezek miflia v'anu omdim mochi temeon u'mechusri havana l'gabi ha'mizrachi. She says, things are happening very, very quickly, and we're left in wonderment, and we don't have the ability to deal with them. But yet, v'aya mishuga mimarei necha, and this is from the Tochacha in Parshas Kitavo, that it will, things will seem crazy in your eyes. So amedvar mamurim, so kol od gishtanu novas umispaseses ala seichel anoshi, as long as we just rely on what a person thinks, that's what it means, that things are going to look crazy. Avalim nisamik betorvi, look in the Torah, nimsa es hakol baru mechuvar. We can see that everything is very clear. I mean, you can look into the Torah, and you can see that this is all fulfillments of various prophecies. And they asked him before he left England, what is this like? And he pulled out a Sefer Daniel, and he started reading Psukim. And the way that when we learned Daniel, I checked my notes, did we have this pshat when we learned Daniel? No, we learned Daniel, it was assumed that these were talking about Titus HaRasha, it was assumed to be talking about earlier periods. And he read it clearly as, this is talking about Hitler, talking about Bizman Hazeh. And therefore, because it's ikvasa de Mashiach, the steps of Mashiach, or the birth pangs of the Mashiach, there's nothing that we can do to avoid it. The only things that we can do are things to improve our lot, meaning to try to get more merits so that we don't get as impacted as we otherwise would. Now, what are those more merits? Now, there is a book that I have at home entitled The Politics of Tradition. It is about the founding of the Agudas Yisrael movement in the early, in the 20s and 30s. Also has that issue about Das Torah, right? That was part of what Agudas Yisrael was. So he writes here that how do people deal with these imposing things? Source number five. So he says, some thinkers in the religious Zionist camp also invoked the notion of Chevli Mashiach. They also said these are birth pangs of the Mashiach as the overarching explanations for the traveling into war period. They differed vehemently with Aguda as to the operative conclusions one should draw from such explanation. Meaning, what they say, if you are a religious Zionist and these things are happening in Europe, what did you assume? Like his Aguda counterparts, Rabbi Yitzhak Nissenbaum, the religious Zionist, saw the hand of providence in the catastrophic events of the time. But unlike them, he saw the present calamities as stemming at least in part from the refusal of the masses of Jewry to enlist in the cause of rebuilding the land of Israel. Meaning, if you were a religious Zionist and you saw these things were happening, why was it happening? So, what do you mean? We're all supposed to be going to Israel. That's why Europe is being destroyed. Right? And that's what he writes explicitly. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, on the other, what did the Agudas suggest as the Jewish people do in the times of crisis? Right, so Rav Elchanan Wasserman pointed to the advice offered long ago, Rabbi Elazar in Talmud, to be saved from Chevli Mashiach, a person should engage in the Torah study of Torah and perform acts of kindness. Right, if you were in the Hasidic world, it was become, you know, get more dveikus with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? But that's what, right? So he doubled down, so to speak, on his strategy and said, well, it means we're not learning hard enough. It means we're not doing enough chesed. And therefore we have to go and we have to drill down and work even harder on ensuring that our Talmud Torah doesn't get abated. Now, the next source, number six, is probably the most controversial. Now, as things were descending from worse to worse to worse, so there's a question, when would Rav Elchanan kind of back out? When would he, right? At the end, Rav Elchanan did encourage everybody to try to figure out their ways to save themselves. Right? He didn't say until the last moment, and we'll see exactly what his story was at the end. But actually, let's go back a little bit. So he goes back to, he ends up back in Baranovich. He actually spends Rosh Hashanah of 1939 in Baranovich for the first time. That was the first time that he ever spent Rosh Hashanah in yeshiva. As we said, he used to go to other places. On September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland. On September 14th, is the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and bombing begins in Baranovich itself. They have to exit the Beis Medrash, I believe, just from reading the various accounts, that Rosh Hashanah was Thursday, Friday, Shabbos. So on Friday afternoon, he paskened, all right, we have to leave Baranovich, take these things, and he gave a list. Apparently, the Chafetz Chaim had already said, if you need to run out of a city on Shabbos, these are the things you should take. We'll take that, and the entire yeshiva, the entire town, evacuates Baranovich, and they walk as far as they get to a certain point on Shabbos, on Friday night. Rav Chanan says, this is far enough, we're safe here. They stop, they spend Shabbos in this place, and then they're stuck. What do they do? Now, the yeshiva then goes back, actually, to Baranovich, the yeshiva as a whole. But and they meet there, as I said before. Baranovich was a meeting town, right? It was where railroads collected. Rav Aaron Cutler and his entire yeshiva shows up in Baranovich. They hear, right? This is now Russia. This is when Russia and Germany both invaded Poland as part of the what was that pact? The Molotov, the Ribbentrop-Molotov Treaty. So they're dividing Poland. Now, part of the miracle of that treaty is that they also decided that Lithuania is now going to be independent, and Vilna will be part of independent, nationalized Lithuania. So Lithuania now all of a sudden becomes a country again. Now, Lithuania is not going to have the same policies that Russia and Germany had. And by the way, it was unclear where you were better off. Were you better off being captured by Germans, or better off being captured by the Russians, or being behind Russian lines or German lines? In hindsight, it doesn't appear that way, but that at that time they didn't know. During World War I, it was better to be captured by Russians than it was to be by it was better to be captured by Germans than it was to be by Russians, right? So there was a lot of confusion. Rav Elchanan and Rav Aaron Cutler both undercover head to Vilna. They consult, and Rav Chaim Ozer, who was in Vilna, says, "Bring all of the yeshivas here into Vilna." So all of the yeshivas that existed in Lithuania at that time, I'm not sure if Slobodka really even existed continuing at that time, but you know, Mir, the famous Mir, that's how Mir got out eventually by going through Russia, right? That because they ended up in Vilna. All of these yeshivas ended up in Vilna for a few months. Rav Chaim Ozer says, I'll see to it that all of these yeshivas gain support. Anybody want to guess, by the way, how many yeshiva students there were combined?
1,000.
It's not that many. 2,500 is what they put, is the number that they mention here, right? The way we think about it in the lore is that it was thousands and thousands of people descending on Vilna. It's 2,500, which is a significant number, obviously, but it's not, you know, that's the number. The number is about 2,500. They get spread throughout Vilna. After a while, the Lithuanian government comes and says, you can't stay here in Vilna anymore, you guys have to spread yourselves out. Rav Elchanan moves the yeshiva to a town called Troki. After that, they move even to a smaller town named Smilshoki. And over the course of that time, then, the curtain closes, Russia invades Lithuania, Russia takes over Lithuania, and the communists are now imposing their will upon the yeshiva. The communists are trying to end the yeshiva, and gezeira after gezeira, rule after rule is now imposed on the yeshivas, making things very, very difficult to continue the yeshiva's existence. During this time, I checked the date, but during this time, there were all sorts of questions on, can we get out? And this is a very controversial part of Rav Elchanan's life. Rav Elchanan was asked in source number six, somebody asked that he had a visa to go to get into Yeshiva University, to go to YU, to which Rav Elchanan told him not to go. Chanan told them, he says, students are those in Dr. Revel in New York and Hebrew Theological College in Chicago. Both institutions are permeated with spiritual dangers since their fundamental principles are contrary to the Torah. What good will result if you escape from physical danger only to encounter spiritual peril? Now that fits with his hashkafa of, you're not any better off there, right? You're not any better off there. Who knows what's going to happen here? Who knows what's going to happen there? Right? So I think people hold this letter up as being, you see, that this was, right? It's not so crazy at the time, especially after surviving Europe for however long they've been there, hundreds and hundreds of years. The assumption was, in the early 40s was, this is very, very bad, this is very, very difficult, but we've survived bad things before. And that was his approach, I believe, when he wrote that letter. This story is actually told in, that's not in the biography of Rav Elchanan. In the actual biography of Rav Elchanan, in Rav Elchanan, it tells this story. He says that there was a friend who came to him, that he actually got hired as a job to be a rabbi in an American congregation, which guaranteed a visa. I mean, that would be a non-quota visa, and be able to go to America. Rav Elchanan told, all he needed, and Rav Chaim Moser said that he should go. Rav Chaim Moser said, go. All he needed was a letter, because he was a rabbi in Baranovich. So he needed a letter from Rav Elchanan testifying that he was a rabbi in Baranovich. So he went to Rav Elchanan for this letter. See that second paragraph. The friend was confident that Rav Elchanan would help him escape from Europe without the slightest hesitation. But Rav Elchanan held back. How can I help you emigrate to America when you have small children? Here we are in great physical danger, but is it a secret that there is tremendous spiritual danger facing children in America? I mean, who says you're going to be any better off over there? The friend told him that Rav Chaim Ozer said that it's okay, right? Das Torah. To which Rav Elchanan said, well, Rav Chaim Ozer is certainly reliable and he may do as his great intelligence dictates. For myself, however, I hesitate to advise people with school-aged children to immigrate to America. Now, the story ends there. I don't know who this was. I don't know if Rav Elchanan relented and wrote him the letter. I don't know. But that was the attitude at that time. Now, Life goes on. It gets increasing more and more difficult in these places in Russia. He ultimately realizes that they're out to get him. They're out to get particularly him. He's the Rosh Hashiva. The communists are going to arrest him. They're going to send him to Siberia. He escapes. He runs back into to Kovna, which I think at that time was under Russian control. He runs back to Kovna. Kovna and Slobodka are across the river from one another. Kovna was the very large town. Slobodka was a suburb which had the very large yeshiva in it. The yeshiva actually was still functioning, because it says he went to Davin by the yeshiva in Slobodka, and he went to and he hid by a house. The house known as the Before we get there, there's a part of the story that it was now June 1941. Very little is known what happened the winter 1940, early 1941. In June 1941, there it is understood, I'm not sure if they know this for sure, that he had a way that he was going to be smuggled into Sweden. He was going to go illegally into Sweden. He was going to take his kids. As they were loading the bags, a bag fell on his son's leg, and his son broke his leg. So they weren't able to take that trip. Instead, they went to Slobodka, and they moved into the house of a rabbi Friedman, of Aryeh Malkiel Friedman. Aryeh Malkiel Friedman lived in the house that Rav Avram Grudzinski. Rav Avram Grudzinski was the Mashkiach of Slobodka. He lived downstairs. The owner of the house lived upstairs. Rabbi Friedman's daughter, actually, is Rachel Cutler. Rachel Cutler is Rav Schneer Cutler's wife. I'm not sure if she's still alive, but this is not ancient history. The house still stands. This is the house. This is the picture of the house where Rav Elchanan stayed for those couple of weeks. During that time, the Germans then declared war on Russia. Well, Russia occupied Poland, right? So the Germans then attacked. They hear the planes overhead. The Lithuanians who lived there didn't wait for the Germans to come. The Lithuanians enacted a pogrom and killed hundreds and thousands of people. They went through Kovna, finding any Jew that they possibly can. They rounded them up. They sent them to a place called the Seventh Fort, which is outside of Kovna. The Seventh Fort was recently in the news. There was an article in the Times of Israel a couple of weeks ago where you saw it, where apparently the Seventh Fort is now used for weddings. It's a very controversial. You saw that, right? It's a very controversial thing. Not necessarily the part where they actually killed all the people, but it said in the article that the guy who bought the place was looking around at his new property, and he came across this small pond, and he reached in and he found human bones, like just what he thought. He called the authorities, and Lithuania doesn't, like, they don't have any money to deal with this kind of stuff, so like nothing really happened. But that that place still exists. The Rav Elchanan hid in this house. You actually can see here. This is the picture of the hallway in that house where Rav Elchanan was hiding and learning, and they just continued learning. Rav Elchanan gave shiurim during that time, and while there were hordes and riots going on outside, for some reason this house was protected, and no one came in. But eventually there was a kid, the way they found out, there was a child who had a note to bring to Rav Elchanan. He was caught by Lithuanians. They realized that it was to Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who was in town. They fought their way into the house. They rounded up 13 of the males there, who were all Talmidei Chachamim, Rav Elchanan chief amongst them. And there is a recording. And Rav Elchanan realized that that was the end. There is, when they grabbed him, he was in the middle of learning. They grabbed him right from his Gemara. And the story goes is that there was a German and a Lithuanian soldier, or a Lithuanian was probably just a thug, but a Lithuanian and German soldier, and they push him against the wall, and they were both, lack of a better term, freaked out, just looked at him and the Kedusha, and the German actually said to the Lithuanian, maybe we should just leave him alone, this is scaring me. The Lithuanian said, no, we're going to take him with all the other ones. They drag him out. There is a recording from Rav Oshri, who became the Shailos HaTshuvos Mimamakim. I think we learned about some of his tshuvos last year. He survived the war, wrote the shailos that he was asked during the war, and that is collected in Rav Elchanan's Sefer in Kovetz Shiurim. In the first three pages are devoted to stories about his life. I don't know how this happened, at what point that there's a rip down the middle of one of them, but on the last page it actually records his last words, the last recorded words that we have. Now, just to conclude the story, he was taken to the 7th fort. There were attempts to try to free him by bribery, to try to get him out. Within 24 hours, he was they machine-gunned everybody. They just killed everybody that was there, and he was amongst thousands who were killed at that point. But he turned to his people, and he continued, this was his hashkafa. And I have the underline, you have it both in Yiddish and then in Hebrew. He says, "Uvimromim machashim alinu kitzadikim kinir." He says, he turned to the people there. He says, "It appears that they consider us like righteous people." Kinivcharu lechaper bigufosenu al klal Yisrael. So we've been chosen to gain atonement for with our bodies for on behalf of klal Yisrael. Ilazos anu tzrichim lashuv laHashem b'tshuva shlemo miyad b'makom hazman katzar haderech lemifsar Mifsar Hatashi, the place where they were going to get them is Krova. He says, if that's what we were chosen for, we don't have much time because we're heading to this place, which is not far away. Alein Ladas ki karvanosenu yala yoser leratzon ayidei tshuva. You should realize that our korban, meaning ourselves, will be accepted more if we do the appropriate tshuva at this time. By a dekach Nagid Eshem Shelachinu V'Achiyosenu B'America. And this is how you should, and Natsil, and by this way, we will hopefully be able to save our brothers and sisters in America. And then at the second line here, a paragraph below, Shelo Hala B'Rayonenu Ezu Shehi Machshav Apostle Chas V'Shon. You shouldn't have in your mind anything that's Apostle Shehi Kepigul Posel Pazal will destroy the Korban. And it says, Anu Mekaymun Ates HaMitzvah Hachi Gedola. We're going to fulfill now the mitzvah, this big mitzvah. Ba'esh Hatzasu Ve'esh Ta'asid Livnosa. He said, with fire, this actually was in Dafyomi a couple of days ago, with a fire Hashem destroyed, and with a fire he's ultimately going to build. Ha'esh HaYokra Eskufotenu Hi Ha'esh Shetasur V'Takim Mich Space Israel, that this fire that is now going to destroy our bodies will be the fire that's now going to go in and renew Klal Yisrael. And that is he maintained his hashkafa until the very end. I don't think there's any, this is what he believed, this was his Torah, and I think, and whether there are points in this story which we disagree with and perhaps we are almost scared by, I think we could certainly gain inspiration from the emunah that he felt throughout his life till the very end.
Did he know that